what do you actually see yourself as?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think an awful lot of people would recognize it because you've, yeah, you play music in different places, and you're very much a part of a scene in Dublin. That's of its time, you know. But yeah. I also think that in a way DJing is sort of very limiting in the way that it defines you as somebody who plays music.
Yeah.
I think you're bigger than that, and I wondered what.
I feel like an intrinsic part of the cloak of Dublin. I feel like I'm definitely a thread, one of the thread counts.
Maybe a zipper or a button.
Yeah, or an epaulette.
3 minutes in.
I wouldn't be the gusset. I wouldn't like to think of myself as the gusset. Gusset. But I do like saying that word as much as the word repulses me. No, I do know what you mean though, as in it feels like more. I definitely feel like I'm a bit like you. I think I work as much as I have to and I enjoy my spare time, but I don't get to travel and holiday as much. I could be working more if I wanted to. I'm not complaining. Do you know what I mean? But I enjoy my free time as much as I enjoy my work, you know? And I don't work for the man, and I...
An artist almost, or even... No, you wouldn't even go that, would you? Like a person...
I never say artist. I never really use that.
You bring people together.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time thinking about that. Is there a way of making that a career? Is that just something that's part of my personality that I really enjoy? Do I just like seeing ideas go from this to this? Mostly I just like buzzers knowing each other and seeing what comes of that. And I struggle a lot with that thought of how much more I could be doing how I could be making money out of the things that I do that just feel very natural to me.
Because I know you love music, because I know you're really in love with music, mm-hmm. as a thing, and I know that powers everything sort of as a... But I always feel that that's almost like a feeling as opposed to a thing that you do.
Yeah, it's a vocation. It's not more than a vocation, you mean.
Yeah, you get up and you go to work one side of you, and that obviously has to pay. But the other side of it is music fuels that.
Yeah.
For you, I think. And I think that I would agree.
Yeah, it's fundamentally the thing. But no, there's a lot of other things. I mean, just general things that unify you to other people. Doing other fun stuff. Like, I don't really know how else to describe that. So I've come on board with the lads in Greedy Pig, especially Greg. And I've been friends. There's a lot that goes back and forth between the two of us, and then you know how everyone develops their ideas and their things, and he said, you know, it would be, you're the kind of head that we like to have around, and there's no real role for me there as such, but come on board and see what happens kind of thing. So I started working in the store, getting to know the art that's in there, getting to know the people that come in, getting to know what they're after. So it's kind of fun to be part of something in its very early stages like that.
So you're like working, you're going to be like...
Yeah, so I started working in the store. I did like two shifts there, and it was really nice. It was really nice to talk to people that come in about the stuff and about Dublin and about the Greedy Pig and about Hen's Teeth. And it's really nice. It doesn't feel like retail. I was in retail for years. It doesn't feel like what that felt like. You know, you're selling something for somebody else that you're getting it. You know, like feels like you're part of something bigger. But the noise of your keys. It's all he can hear in the headphones.
It's all right.
So there's that. And I do a podcast with Niall O'Nine called Loose Joints. And I do a podcast in Dublin Digital Radio with my pal Gareth called White Noise. We had White Noise and whatnot. Now it's White Noise Rude. So... podcasting, I think initially radio was where I thought I'd end up. I think that was the big dream. I thought that used to be the goal. And I think for a long time I thought you could only do that if you went to you know, were a runner in Today FM for years, and then eventually you'd be allowed into a studio. Now everyone's doing it, and technology has, you know, we're sitting here with a little Zoom and a phone and a mic. You can go and do that anywhere. It doesn't. So that's changed it completely. DJing as well, I think, you know. But that's more about clout, I think, and graft and being likable and being friendly.
Did you find it hard to get to be a DJ in Dublin? At the beginning?
I didn't really find it hard to get gigs, but then I was told a lot by my peers, who were all blokes, and my friends. You know, they were a little resentful of the gigs that I was getting because they felt that it was just because I was a girl and it was very novel. And that people would book me and know that I'd wear a nice dress and I'd have a little bit of a dance and have a bit of crack. But then I had to really make sure that when that sort of seeped into me and made me very uneasy, I had to make sure that I was good enough so that I didn't feel like I was getting booked just because I was a girl, do you know?
That must have been awful, sort of, it could have been a bit.
Yeah, it was very daunting. It's very daunting.
It annoyed you?
People didn't come to your gigs and say, well done, that was brilliant. Lads didn't. I do feel a lot that I sat back and I was waiting to be given more opportunities instead of leaning in and taking them. I feel like I did that for a long time. I sat back and waited to be welcomed into the gang when there wasn't really a gang and it wasn't really anyone else's. You know, I shouldn't have been waiting. I should have leaned into that. I do regret that a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Seeing your name lower down on a poster to somebody that you know you're better than, essentially, and yeah, that you've been at it a longer time and saying nothing. Not asking about fees, what other people are getting, and not really wanting to know. Probably because you knew that they were going to be getting a lot more than you and you didn't want to fall out with a booker or a... There's a lot of stuff that I was just very grateful about being booked where I shouldn't have been. I should have been a bit more. I was afraid of my life of looking like, or coming across like a diva, or, you know, being a bit brattish. When I think about it now, I just think, Jesus, I should have been a bit more wide and a bit more sold myself a bit better, do you know?
Well, why do you think that, say, especially male DJs would be afraid of just. Is it because they don't want other people getting the work that they think that they deserve, or do you actually think it was sexism?
I do. I feel like it was fundamentally a woman moving into a very male dominant. I think misogyny is so inherent in all of us, like a familiarity with misogynistic behaviour, that it's second nature to some.
Both male and
I think female. Women are familiar with misogynistic behaviour,
with the language,
without even thinking about
it. And sort of laughing it off a little.
Yeah, and pandering to it and adapting to it. And I have this conversation with people a lot. There are things that men regularly say to me while I'm DJing. And I know, because it happens all of the time, that I know that they're not necessarily horrible dudes. They just don't know how wrong. They don't know the place they're coming from.
Yeah.
They approach you with a suggestion of what you should play or do or say. Or if you answer them in a way that's like, fuck off, let me do my job or whatever. They get so insulted and so embarrassed that you had to call them out on something they're saying to you, that their knee-jerk reaction is to insult you. You know?
Defense. Like.
Yeah, yeah. They get defensive and they go, well, you're a fucking shit DJ anyway, and you're an ugly bitch. It's like they have to.
Like, that's happened.
Yeah.
You've had that.
Oh, listen. I would say once a month for my entire career, somebody has said something to me that's made me so fucking angry that I'd either respond or I'll sit in it, but it stays with you for days. It doesn't go anywhere. And it can really make you want to not play, and it can knock your confidence. And I don't think people realise that. People feel it's their duty to come over and advise a DJ for some reason on what to do. And when you turn that around and go, if they go, can I go through your record bag? And I go, can I go through your handbag? Just to kind of show them the level of how daft our question is, their response is always very, yeah. Yeah, you know, the whole smile. why aren't you smiling? You know, you're very cranky. You know, or then you get the other side of it, which is a lad who comes over going, do you know what? Myself and my friend were sitting there saying the music was rapping. And next thing we look down and there's a board. Couldn't believe it. Fucking fair play to you. And you have to still respond graciously that they're saying, despite the fact that you're a woman, we're actually really enjoying the music tonight. Do you know what I mean? And you have to go, oh, thanks a million.
That's weird.
Cheers, I'm delighted you're having a good time. But the amount of men in music that I know that didn't realise that that happens so much. Most men would, you know, it's the same as taxi drivers or, you know, drivers with women on bikes. Get out of the fucking road, you fucking idiot. Watch the fucking light, you dozy cow. They wouldn't do it as a bloke because you'd probably get off your bike and go over and punch him. Do you know, but there's a way you can speak to a woman that you know she's going to back down.
And he should know better.
Yeah, but it's a way that some men feel they can speak to a woman a certain way because what's the worst she's going to do? What's the worst she's going to do? The worst she's going to do is say something insulting. And when they say something insulting, that's crippling.
Okay. So is it not changing? So
I think it absolutely is, yeah.
You must be delighted just in regards to, say Leo Varadkar there recently just said, right, let's have this referendum in May. Okay, just as a thing. But then I see Steve Aoki on the internet selling his new single by telling everybody that more women should be DJing. And it's totally the same fucking thing of using that as a way of promoting himself as not an actual DJ.
Yeah, that's...
Things have changed or are changing and, you know, obviously online.
Yeah.
I think you ladies took online and ran with it. It's a thing now, a force for you in the sense that...
It's the greatest somebody said mode of communication.
It's having a newspaper without the losses is what Donald Trump
said. Yeah, well, that's a good way of putting it.
But in the sense of that, things are changing, but at the same time, you're saying that things remain the same.
I think maybe the biggest change for me is feeling more supported, maybe more understood, rather than the feeling a little stronger in my place in my shoes. But there's two things. I want to go back to the thing you said about the dudes who kind of cash in on the whole Me Too thing for self. Promotion. There's two sides to that, I think. One is everybody wants to be on the right side, nobody wants to be the baddie. Everyone wants
things
to
changing.
Yeah, yeah. But also, history. I feel like you know, when people complain about like dudes going around wearing repeal jumpers and you know, like really giving it. I'm like, so what? It doesn't matter if they're personally invested in it. It's still the good word being spread. It's still promotion. Do you know what I mean? It's still.
But would you imagine that maybe men don't seem to feel they have a choice in them in that particular matter? That it's a thing that women decide for themselves in regards to their own, especially with their own bodies. But in the sense of, say, equal opportunities work-wise, we would have a say in that. So there's a little difference there, and I wondered what part has changed for you in both of those respects.
I don't know. That's. I don't really know how to answer that because I haven't personally seen a huge shift, like financially or money-wise or whatever. But. I don't know. I think either way, all of us feel fundamentally a change is coming.
Yeah.
And I kind of get annoyed when, because I hear a lot of people going, there's one thing that keeps going, like, this has been going on for years. You know, this has been going on for years. I'm like, okay, but now is the time that it's, people are thinking about it differently. And I do feel like it's the ultimate threat to men, especially if they're not.
Twitter.
No, I think this whole movement is the ultimate threat to men.
Yeah, but the means of getting that message out via, say, Twitter or online has changed that. And I think that was true of religion in that sense. And you could get information about things that were happening.
Yeah, and people...
I don't know if there's any difference in that. I just think that's, like I said earlier on, women just in general took that medium and ran with it and used it as a way of saying, look, this is what's going on.
But like anyone, like any circle of human beings that are oppressed in any way and are finding a way of a release of some sort. Of course, I think the biggest thing about Me Too is it's not about, it's not really about shaming men, it's more about hearing each other and saying, I hear you.
Yeah.
I hear you. I believe you, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, any argument you hear that's like, well, what if he didn't? And you know, you can't even touch a woman's leg anymore. And you can't just like, all of that is just a little bit of you trying to defend something that you feel threatened about losing. And what is that? Control. You know,
yeah.
If men who don't mind women being in control or being equals are not going to be threatened by that.
Yeah.
You know, the men who are shouting the loudest going, fuck's sake, you can't even do this and you can't even do that. And so Jesus, come on, lads, like everybody knows that in some stage or at some one, at least one incident, they've slightly abused their power to gain something or favor. Do you know what I mean? Every man knows he's witnessed or probably been part of something, however mild, that he knew was kind of bad form. And the woman was most likely going to suck it up and overlook it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yep.
And for a very long time, women just suck it up. Because I think fundamentally, we've as much as men have inherently been made to feel superior, women have fundamentally been trained to not embarrass or hurt a man's feelings, or to embarrass him or shame him, because they know that's the ultimate thing. You know, like, do you remember that study was done? I read about this thing where they interviewed 100 women around the world and 100 men around the world, different ethnicities, different backgrounds, different communities, different social settings. And they asked the same question. What is the thing that you fear the most about the opposite sex? What is the thing that you find that, what's the worst thing that they could do to you, basically? And all of the men said, that they can laugh at me. That was the worst thing that they felt that they could, that's the worst place women could go with them. The majority of the women said that they can kill me. That if I had to think of the absolute worst, that would be the thing that I'd be most afraid of. So it even shows how women's brains work, that like going, well, Jesus, if you're going really the worst, then that's really the worst. But actually the really the worst a man could think of was that they would embarrass me or insult me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's just the
problem. So that's to me, that's very telling in loads of ways.
Yeah,
one, by how we're trained, two, by how more forgiving I think we are as a species, to be like, well, Jesus, what's the worst they could do? Well, kill me, I suppose. You know, but also, yes, they can fucking kill you. They're much stronger than you and they can kill you, you know?
Yeah.
And men don't ever have to think that way. They don't ever, ever have to think that way. Now, I don't know any man who has to go. Now, this happens to me regularly. Not happens to me, but I've done this for a long time. I live in Temple Bar. I DJ late at night. I've always got my headphones on, and I've always got Pierce Street Garda Station, like, ready to hit dial. I've always got a bunch of keys in my hand for somebody approaching you. So you're always, your journey home, you prepare for some sort of... Now, it never happens, luckily. I've never had to do that. But what I'm saying to you is, there's people who don't even ever have to think about that.
Yeah,
most of those people are men.
I feel like that as well. Let me in there. I feel that way as well. Like, I feel nervous in Dublin. I think that's just because Dublin has changed greatly. It's more people in a very compact space. So but I'm not taking away from what you're saying, because I think you're right.
It's just a very small example of how women are always having to think about themselves, their safety.
Yeah.
They're keeping yourself in fucking tact, basically.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's just a fundamental thing that men don't really have to spend any time thinking about. I mean, I'm not talking about safety in a country, I'm talking about as a woman.
Yeah.
You know, you're just that bit more vulnerable.
That's different. That's a very, very different.
Now, I'm not saying that I'm going around like, you know, rape alarm and fucking, do you know, what I'm saying to you is, it's just, you always have to think about your safety.
Did you always feel like that, or has that become more than?
No, always, always.
Always. Do you think that will ever change?
I hope so. I mean, even on a smaller scale, walking past a group of men sitting around the bar, and they stop talking when you walk past. You know that they're muttering something about you to each other. That's intimidating. A bloke making a noise at you out of a car, driving past, shouting something at you. That's intimidating. What are the chances you're going to go, oh, really, you fancy me? Here, stop the car, I'll get in the back. Like, what's the chances? I've been wolf whistled when I've been pushing a baby in a buggy, minding children, and somebody shouts out the window and you're like, oh, yeah, here, I'll just leave the kids here at the side of the road and I'll get in the van with you, will I? Do you know what I mean? They only did that to make you feel uncomfortable. They didn't do it to compliment you. They did it to make you feel uncomfortable. They did it to make themselves feel more masculine.
So how do you turn that into this feeling that you have? How do you turn that into something that helps you get through those kind of weird...
I have to say, in a really long time, I haven't been wolf whistled at, or anything very derogatory hasn't been said to me. And I've walked past enough building sites and enough of those places that were usually very intimidating. And I think, genuinely, on a small scale, but maybe a very large scale, men are beginning to think about themselves and how they present themselves and why you might. It's in everyone's psyche. Everyone's thinking about it now.
Yeah.
There's nobody gone, that doesn't appeal. That doesn't apply to me.
Yeah.
Everyone's thinking about it now. Everyone's thinking about it. But and that's what's so important.
I know. Everybody is not you. So how do you use this energy to turn...
No, I'm saying my experience would suggest that everybody is thinking about it.
But would you use that? Maybe I'll rephrase the question. If you use that to kind of... Would you,
as a positive.
Then you positively go and talk to everybody that you know, including this conversation, and say, look... You know, weirdly enough, I just think of Dee Creasy, and I just imagine sitting with Dee all day going, right, that stew is ready, but I need to chat to you.
We talk about it a lot.
Do you actively canvass for the idea of something that's very, very different?
Yeah, I speak to a lot of my male friends, my male peers. Like, you know me, I'm rarely not surrounded by a gang of pals, mostly lads usually, so it's not, there's no... This is a very good time for women like me who have really good men around them. Even the really good men will say things like, you know, somebody very close to me said recently, oh, but Jesus, can you imagine now the amount of women that will come out with false allegations because their career failed and they want it. And I just went, stop right there. Probably not that many, actually, because men never have to think about the absolute horror and fear and shame and embarrassment of coming forward with a story that something happened to you, and how it exposes you on a level that you didn't want to go into, you know?
Yeah.
But secondly, I don't think women really operate that way. There's definitely, of course, some women who do, but I think the very notion that men would think about that makes women not come forward. So it's like, think about your suspicion, think about that. How big a thing do you think it is? Probably not that many. I think it's probably not that many women. So maybe put it out of your head. You know, so think about it differently. Change your language. Change your angle on it.
Would you actively call out individual conversations?
Yeah, of course. This is the time that people do that now.
But I get the impression that you would have done this way, way before this consciousness came up.
Yeah, but I think people are more open to it now, maybe, you know?
Yeah, because, you know, it's... vindication of what you've always been.
Absolutely.
Sort of thinking about.
Yeah, just going, this is not fucking
but you're
fair.
That kind of character. You're that big of a character, you know, like you're way bigger, and I've said this at the beginning, and I've said this to you before, I think you're way bigger than the idea of just being actually Sally, you know. I think there's like this thing that you could fit into something bigger.
Yeah.
And I'm asking you to think about the energy that comes from this and other things that maybe drive you a bit mad, which I'll ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stupid things, funny things that we
just... The rage. Back to the rage.
You didn't have to say that.
Oh, sorry. What? That was what we called it.
We called it the rage.
Yeah.
But that energy of turning that but as you do, calling out people or saying, look, I'm not really comfortable with this as a thing.
Mm.
You know, you have conversations with people that really drive you mad. So how do you, are you actively thinking about using this sort of energy that is now evident, and as mm-hmm. you say, it vindicates you, what you've always been talking about.
Yeah.
About getting into something that would be for the greater good.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Hopefully we'll start with this talk tomorrow in Trinity and see how it goes. It's part of the student union sort of, it's a festival of sort of technology information. I'm not actually really sure how to describe it, but
did you ever?
Yeah, I feel glad to be part of that.
Did you ever think of yourself as?
Yes, I am the lady. I do want to be the Lord Mayor. Okay,
so
I'm glad you got around to it. I have looked into it.
I would vote for you, though.
I know you
would. But socially, like a thing where you would be sitting with somebody just like this and going, "What's wrong with you?
Yeah,
can I help you? You know, a facilitator. You know, my mum was a facilitator for a long time.
Yeah,
out of her own depression into something where she did. She could give the story back to people, mm-hmm. you know, and that would drive her mad. You know, people would turn up and just say, you know, oh, I'm having a really bad day with my boss. They wouldn't mm-hmm. actually talk about themselves, you know.
So yeah, they'll do everything other than the actual issue that's wrong with them. Yeah.
Have you ever thought of that as a thing of maybe helping people on that level?
I have, because I'm currently and going through a very painful breakup of. Yeah, it's been going on for quite a while, and I actually saw therapy a couple of months ago, and it was the best thing I ever did.
Were you afraid of that before you went
No.
in?
No, I wasn't actually, which is something that I've realised is fundamentally important, that you have to be open and ready for the box being open and not being able to be closed again.
That's a lovely
I was
way.
A little.
It's a lovely way of putting
it. But you know what I mean? Yeah, that's absolutely. Why people don't want to go, because they know the shit that's going to come out, and Pandora's going to be fucking bats and snakes with wings flying all over the shop, and you can't close that box again. You have to attack every one of those monsters and think about it. And I like to think about things very analytically and with fairness and kindness and heart. And I'd like to always think of myself as not somebody who is afraid to say sorry. And I think that's a really good quality that I have, that I like about myself. Do you know, that I really think about it and go, was I being a dickhead there? Am I the asshole in the equation? If there's a chance that I'm open to that always, do you know?
Right, can I stop you?
Yeah. Oh, Jesus. I shouldn't have let you stop me. I'm going to regret this now.
No, because I feel the very, very same. I think, I think that, you know what, and I'm not saying, I think we're getting older. So mm-hmm. we kind of see the damage that we may or may not have done to others because mm-hmm. we've said something stupid.
Yeah.
There might have been a couple of glasses of wine.
Mm-hmm. A few Cuba Libres.
You sound like a dad again.
I know.
Cuba Libres.
As soon as I do any sort of male thing, I'm channeling my dad.
It's
yeah,
your dad,
yeah,
which I believe is a beautiful thing. This relationship you have with your father and your mother is incredible.
Yeah, sir. It's their wedding anniversary on the 2nd of March. Then the Wiley Fox.
That 3 days of fucking photographs of you dancing in some kit.
Well, I'd like if you came and danced with us, perhaps. That was your invite.
Thanks.
Were you pissed all over it?
So you get older and you want to go back to these people that you've had arguments with, and then you say, look. My argument with people, about arguments with people, is are we not kind of the same? Are we not cut from the same cloth? That's the reason mm-hmm. why I don't get on with you, is because you're just as brilliant as I am.
I think that's a cop-out. Do you not?
Well,
it's a bit like moving the shit from your side of the street to their side of the street and going, I think we're both the same. If it's the shit's on your side of the street, you have to fucking clear that shit. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'll remember you said that next time I do this.
But do you know what I'm saying to you, though? I'm not saying that in an insulting way. What I mean is,
of course,
all the time we go, it's actually easier if I just... Sometimes this is what I... When somebody acknowledges...
But what about the person who said that thing to you and you were like, this particular man said this thing to you about, mm-hmm. you know, oh, you're a shit DJ anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So this person annoys you because they're high and mighty, you know, so in a way I'm facilitating their over
ego
anxiety by trying not to be anxious and egotistical, which I think I could be sometimes. So is that different?
Yeah, I think it is. Once you're in check with yourself and you're happy with it, and there's not many people who would disagree with you, then you can only be accountable for your own behaviour. And I went to therapy going, fuck, I'm fucked, aren't I? And she was just like, let's figure out a few things here. Yes, there's definitely these things from your childhood over here. Yes, there's definitely this relationship you have with these people in your family. Yes, there's definitely, you know, you've learned some things that have carried on into your adulthood that you probably brought into a relationship, and they're, you know, you put other people first, you don't think about your own feelings, and then you get really hurt. And she was like, so what do you want? And I was like, I want to break bad patterns. And she's like, right, start at the start. And then my therapist is brilliant. Her name is Sarah, and she's young, and she's like, she knows me, and we have similar friends. So I didn't find that threatening. I found that actually quite relieving, because she knew exactly where I was coming from at all times. But also she's super professional, and she talks as much as I talk in it. We discuss things. So it's a really good, healthy discussion. It's never like, she just goes, here's what I think about what you just said. Do you think that you do this? And everything's presented in a very presentable, non-judgmental way. And that was huge for me, because I'd gone to counselling before, where it was like, how does that make you feel? And you're just like, oh, fuck off. You want to flip a table. You're just like, give me answers. Give me structure. Mm. So I think therapy, I genuinely believe, I feel that therapy should be compulsory. It should be an obligation as a citizen that you check in with somebody every 4 weeks or 6 weeks or something, just to see how your mental health is doing. I really do think that. I really think that the country would work. People would be socially. You'd catch somebody about to do something very fucking crazy if somebody had to catch. You know what I mean?
You'd feel it.
Listen to the amount of people around the country that are so desperately sad and unhappy or lonely or depressed or don't know it. They just don't know.
Do you think getting, obviously what's going on around us in the world, and then getting just that little bit older, it has allowed you to do that? Or
yeah, be socially responsible.
Was it a thing that pushed you into it? Like an individual moment in your life that decided, okay, well, I need to look.
Yeah, I'd completely taken myself apart, as people do when they fall out or they break up. You look for things that you could have done better, and I did that, but I absolutely dissected myself, and I left myself very low, very exposed, and I needed to start rebuilding myself. And I never want to be that wanker who goes to therapy going, therapy's fantastic, you really should try it, because I think everyone should. And I think the big fear, I've realised the big fear for most people, I think, is opening the box. Once it's open, it can't be closed.
And how do you think that's going to help you kind of doing things next, like things that
because you so because you're say, always what, thinking about
what makes you happy.
Yeah, and
tell us what actually makes you happy. The little simple things, like
feeling loved, feeling safe, feeling like I get a great amount of pleasure from crack. Like, crack is something I really need in my life. I realised I went to New York thinking I was going to have a really cool experience and meet loads of cool guys and, you know, like, just met loads of dopes and went to see loads of great art, but I was really broke and it was really hard for me to get gigs, and they'd pay me $100. It's $25 to the bar in a taxi from where I lived, and it was just like, this is hard, you know? But I couldn't put my finger on what it was, and after a while I went, maybe I'm lonely, but I have good friends. And then it was a couple of pals of mine, you know, Graham and Alan and Lakeith and Graham Finn. And every now and then I'd have to see them, and we'd have to stand in the corner and piss ourselves laughing and just lash each other out with slags. Because it was the only way I could feel a bit like, right, I got a little dose there of just nonsense crack, but I really need that. Yeah. I really need that in my life. I've realised it's a fundamental part of who I am.
There is this thing that you do, and I think Martin McCann will probably agree with me, and probably Graham and Alan mm-hmm. will probably feel the same way, is that you launch into a
crack.
No, you're calling it crack.
You call it rage.
I call it...
Yeah, but I just do it to make you laugh.
I, I call it one-liners, where you just have these things that you say, and they're like...
It's usually my newest thing, my newest gag. I've stored them up and they're presentable to you.
Let me finish. It's an amalgamation of...
Amalgamation.
Of things that you've heard, you know, one little liners, little things, little jokes people have told you.
My stash.
And they're the ultimate icebreakers, you know, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of people feel, well, I do, I don't know, maybe that's just me, but mm-hmm. I feel awkward meeting somebody I haven't seen in a while.
Yeah.
So you do need that little...
I kind of feel I'm very conscious of that, though. I remember being in school as a kid.
Do you use these little things to kind of just...
Yeah, because I know I know the people that feel that way. And I remember being a kid in school and always being very conscious of what shyness is and going... I'm realising how crippling it can be for some kids and always just taking that on a little bit and going, come here, sit here, use my markers. And just being like, you're grand. Do you know, I'm always very conscious of people's... disease, and I try to unease. I think just be kind, make that easier when you meet someone on the street and they're staring at a car, but they're happy to see you, but you know that they find these interactions sometimes a bit harder than you do. So I like to take the lead on that and go, how's it going? You didn't see such and such. Wait and you hear this thing that I heard. You know, and it just gets the ball rolling a bit easier. Do you know? You get this fucking small talk out of the way.
The rage.
The rage is something that all of us have. But I mean, I like to use a ragey rant as a kind of in a comedic sort of easing sense as well.
Even when it's dark and nasty, you make it funny. You know?
Yeah, you have to though.
That's why I think I like talking to you because.
Yeah.
Because it takes a while to get over a conversation with you, you know. Because
okay. It's you have to go and lie down. Dark room, lights off.
It's like, a little bit, you know. But it's brilliant, you know, because you're right. You do this thing where you bring people into a world of Sally Foran, because it is an actual. Existence.
It's a place.
It's an existence. It really, really is, because you are like bright and colourful, and you come with so much in that sense. So that's really, really good that you use those things that drive you mad and turn them into something that's funny.
Yeah. Yeah, because also you're thinking the whole time.
Things? What are those things? You know, what's currently driving you a bit crazy?
What's currently driving you a little bit crazy?
I have something for you.
Oh, I think I'm going to have to go off social media again for a little while. Like, watching the Ray Darcy show and then First Dates. I love it and it gives me the heebie-jeebies in equal measures. Like, I love mortifying television, but also it leaves me a bit going, oh, fuck, Ireland's in bits, you know, in loads of ways.
Why?
Just the... state of radio and the state of TV just the state of that still being
just there to keep you busy until the adverts come up.
Yeah, and...
You've worked that out.
Yeah, of course, that stresses me out.
It's money.
Yeah.
TV and radio is nothing to do with culture anymore. It's about money.
Yeah.
It's about selling.
Yeah.
That's what I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right.
If it was untrue, wouldn't RTE2 be running arts documentaries till 6 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, no, I absolutely am.
Instead of having a holding screen.
I love that I live on the third floor of an apartment where they can't get in, because I'd love take delight if somebody came and asked to see my TV license.
Why aren't we on the actual fucking radio?
I know, because people in Middle Ireland who pay for their TV licenses don't want to hear the likes of me and you talking shite. Do you know what I mean?
But if we were making sense.
Yeah, but too few people were making sense. But who can relate to us in Roscommon? Who are in there? Do you know what I mean? As in, like, the shite we're talking is, like, I think, I don't know. Maybe that's selling us a little short. Maybe that's selling Ireland a little short. But I think, generally, if the stuff on TV is a reflection of what people want in Ireland, and that's measured and researched, then it would suggest that the likes of myself and yourself might not be their cup of tea. I don't know. They don't tend to take a big chance on things. Like, I saw Vogue Williams on travel show recently, and I was like, do you know what? It's about time that they got that girl doing something. Because she's great.
Yeah.
She's a lovely personality. Jesus, I could look at her all day. She's insanely gorgeous. She seems very real. There's no real...
She works really hard.
She works really hard. And I'm like, you know, what's Fade Street? Must be, what, nearly 10 years ago? And now they have her on a travel show, which is probably the best job you could ever have, is going on holiday and reviewing it. You know, and I was like, Jesus, but what, it took them 10 years to get Vogue on a TV show? Or she's lovely, she's relatable, she's presentable. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like 10 years later, they've someone gorgeous like her and good. But maybe that needed that for them to... I mean, it's a travel show. She's not saying anything very controversial, you know. But
again, it could be just a tie-in with certain kinds of advertising.
Yeah,
but
you know.
That's not to demean what...
No, it's not, because I know that she works really hard.
But anybody who wants to work hard and to be a part of a culture should... be recognised, and I think that's true of you. I think it's true.
Well, look at Miles and Deneen doing
for
No Disco.
Don't have an actual slot on RTE 2 or 1. Yeah. At even 2 o'clock in the morning, people would watch that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just don't get that. Why does a holding screen, there's a holding screen on a national TV station that we pay for with no
content. Well, I don't pay for, thank God.
With no content.
Yeah.
And that is... Yeah,
it's terrifying. It's terrifying. 2018, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
But you know,
some things haven't changed.
You look at Miles and Deneen, what they're doing with No Disco. Really lovely. On the ground.
Yeah.
Making it themselves. On a, you know, a shoestring. And it's loved because it's full of heart and passion. And they're doing that because they know they need to do it. No one else is doing it. I was doing a clear out the other day and I found all my old copies of Foggy Notions. Gorgeous magazine. It was €6 at the time. The ones I have from 2005 to 7, say. The articles were brilliant. Some of the reviews were gas. They always had a free CD with amazing tunes on it.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that now.
No, but Hot Press still exists.
Oh, the hack of Hot Press, though, Aidan. Don't get me started on Hot Press.
But that's what people want, obviously.
I don't know anyone that reads Hot Press, do you? Like, it's the worst photography, the worst covers for how many years? Every time you go past it, you see it in the window and you go, how is that still so hacked?
Because they were, I remember hearing that the covers are paid for. You can buy the cover. MCD can buy the cover, or whoever can buy
it. But like, the quality of it is so crap, and it's just the same forever. A review of a gig that was 3 weeks ago, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's in bits. Now, in fairness, I don't pick it up very often. No one said to me in a very long time, you didn't read Hot Press, did you? It's fantastic this month. You know, because you just know it's not. It's the RTE guide with Dave Fanning. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, poor Dave Fanning. I kind of like him.
Yeah, but go away as well. Like, I mean, how is he the only person that has an opinion on music in the past 30 years in Ireland? Do you know what I mean? Let someone else out. Let someone else in.
I think Jim Carroll will probably say the opposite.
As well as Jim Carroll, my saying goes for Jim Carroll, let someone else in.
Yeah.
Give someone else an opinion.
There's no great women in
music giving their opinions, really, is there?
Yeah, that's my next thing to you is like, where's the girl Niall or Nine, you know?
Yeah.
Where's Nolene?
Yeah, but you know what I mean?
Or, you know.
Like, what the best you can get end up being is a radio DJ in a very, very limiting radio station.
Just
playing slightly alternative music.
Setting up for ads.
You don't get to say anything that you feel on those stations. You know what I mean? You don't get to say anything controversial. Podcasts. That's where.
But TXFM was the last thing.
And then look what happened. You know, that's gone. Phantom gone. You know, it's...
Well, they were owned by Dennis O'Brien and they just weren't profitable enough.
So something like the six main radio stations are easy listening now. Just a loop.
Maybe that's what people want.
I don't know. I'd say that's what taxi drivers want. I don't know. That kind of stuff annoys me. A constant reminder of that not changing or going anywhere or moving with the times, you know? Things like that. I think the only place you really see a huge surge is theatre at the minute, with a consciousness of what needs to be going on, what women... And what people want to hear and see and feel, you know?
Yeah,
do you not think
women,
so?
Yeah, absolutely. What about writing? With women's writers?
Definitely. Definitely, but I'm talking about in a before on a before
in a Dublin in yeah. a Dublin scene.
Yeah,
theatre's yeah. huge. Well,
mm-hmm. That's the only place where I've been sort of. Oh, apart from, I saw Sy recently in the. I don't really want to go and slate that because I have a lot of respect for Druid and the people that put on those shows, but it's just Sy was a very dark, weird old, keen play anyway. But it was just kind of done in a slightly panto-y,
yeah.
comedic style, and it was, you
yeah.
know,
yeah.
it's the most oppressively horrible tale of shitty behaviour of old, old Ireland. And it was just like, why that one? Why drag that up and then make it kind of panto and then feed yeah. it to tourists? Do you know?
Well, then what? Well, on the other side of it, then what have yeah. you seen that's quintessentially Irish? That was, you know, probably, well, I suppose Three Billboards was, you know, when I think of Mark
yeah.
McDonagh and his
blew my mind. Watch that movie now.
I know it's not Irish, but I know
no,
he
but
has
you know, a very good friend of mine, Renata, who lived here for a very long time, watched it with her dad in Australia recently, and she said she just kept saying to him, like, this is weird because it feels like it's really Irish, there's something about this that's really yeah. Irish, and it was the dialogue and it was the
yeah.
taking something very bleak and making a horrifically dark joke about it, but also the split second, the emotion is so
yeah.
at the surface all the time, and it can be used, it can go back and forth. And then when it came up, when the credits came up with Mark McDonagh, she was like, I knew it. There was just something about that
yeah,
that was so familiar and brilliant. And
he's amazing, yeah.
And it floored me, and Frances McDormand. Lord me. And I saw her when I was very young playing Blanche DuBois in Streetcar Named Desire in the gate. And I was right up the front because it was the kind of, they were the shitty seats, you know, where your kind of neck is creaked. And I was just like, here, when I saw her. And I was probably in theatre school at the time. I was like, what is going on with that woman? She is incredible, you know. And then, yeah, I've loved her in all of the films for the years, but that really, that character is unreal.
You wouldn't like to
the
take
overalls and the undercut and the just the fucking
yeah, yeah.
kicking your one at the kids.
You wouldn't like to do that yourself, is it?
Kick
somebody around.
I'd love to kick loads of people.
But
in the
I mean on stage.
I went to theatre school. I trained as an actor.
You not tried to do something a bit more?
And then I went. I didn't have the confidence, if I'm honest.
Yeah. It's tough.
Couldn't put my make myself allow myself to be that vulnerable, even though it's exactly what I did to go and be a DJ.
Yeah.
And I cacked it and I hated it and I made and I'd look for any reason to get out of a gig, but something about it made me feel, I think the fact that there wasn't many girls around doing it, and it really bothered me that this was a boys' club, and it was like saying that music is just for boys, that made me really defiantly go against my absolute mortification and how exposed I felt doing it, and make myself work harder at it, do you know?
Yeah.
Whereas with theatre, I went to an audition and everyone's mortified in auditions. Everyone in the room is mortified. Everyone's
yeah.
mortified for you.
Yeah.
And I just did like three and I went, I fucking never let myself feel that scarlet ever again. And I backed out of it, you know? And sometimes I wish I hadn't, because theatre's still a huge love of mine and I go to it a lot, and I'm the absolute cheek of me to be as critical about theatre as I am, just like, stay to that. You know, like, what am I doing? Absolutely nothing but going as a punter and giving out about it. But I sucked up a lot of that fear and mortification maybe I just realised it was way more of a vocational calling for me. I don't know. Music. I was more something I felt more comfortable in.
Yeah. Do you think that's it?
I didn't feel as out of my depth with music.
Do you think that's you won't feel out of your depth the rest of your days? Do you think music will be always a big, big part of your life?
Yeah. Yeah. I do think so. I don't, you know, you hear people going, it's in my veins, it's what keeps me alive. I don't feel like it's in my veins by any means, but I think everybody finds a medium that they feel most emotionally connected to.
You don't think
it's photography,
age,
art, you know.
You don't think age has a bearing on that in any way?
Do you mean like find yourself out of the loop sort of with new stuff, or?
Yeah.
You could find yourself out of the loop, but still find yourself.
Or people's opinions of you. Because you're You know, I was at DJ Derek. Remember the reggae DJ that went off on his own, you know, and he was obviously, I think it was probably Alzheimer's or whatever, you know. But man, those videos of him just doing his thing, and he was like 70 or whatever, really gave me sort of like, Jesus, this fair play to him, you know?
You were like, I could be an absolute lula around Dublin, I'll be still getting gigs, it'll be grand.
Is that not okay?
It's completely okay.
Is that not the way it's going?
Absolutely,
Do you see that for yourself? Do you see?
I don't know. I do constantly feel there is more I could be doing than I'm not. I think definitely I hold myself back there. I went to New York and I didn't really think about what I was looking for there. But when I came home, I asked for a radio slot and I got it in RadioMate. I asked for a gig in a bar that I liked and I got a residency there. And I went, so I have to go all the way to fucking New York to realise that I have this town dialed and all I have to do is ask. Because I do favours for people all the time and people are happy to do favours for you. And I just realised, like, okay, it was a big journey to go to figure that out. But, like, sometimes that's as far as you have to go to realise what you have at home and to realise how easy you could have it. And I definitely do think I look back when I get older and wish I'd worked a bit harder and made a bit more of a, carved out a bigger spot for myself. But at the same time, there's something, I kind of a little, try to be a little bit modest and not, I don't know. I do think about it a lot. I think I'm like, is it laziness or is it fear? Or are you just waiting for somebody to ask you to do something? Do you just expect it to fall into your lap? Do you know? Whereas very ambitious people give me the willies. But at the same time, sometimes I could definitely be a little more ambitious. Do you know, I'm very suspicious of very ambitious people. Because I think that comes from something not great, like a not great place. I don't think that comes from a very kind, self-measured place. I think that comes from a fighty sort of has to be the best or succeed people. I've no real desire in me to succeed anyone or to, do you know what I mean by that?
Do you feel successful?
No, I don't feel successful at all. I feel like a fucking chancer. I do, I feel like a chancer, yeah. I feel like a messer. I definitely don't feel I've achieved my potential or even a quarter of it, no.